Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Claire Clark, a host on the channel, and today we'll be talking to James L. Nolan, Jr. about his new book, Atomic Doctors, Conscience and Complicity at the Dawn of the Nuclear Age. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder if you could begin our interview by telling us just a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I grew up in Southern California. I did my undergraduate work at UC Davis in California, and then I did my graduate work and my doctoral work at the University of Virginia in sociology. And while I was at UVA, I encountered for the first time the work of the French sociologist Jacques Ellul, and his writings were important in my thinking about technology and certainly informed some of the analysis in this book, Atomic Doctors.
Well, so the story of how you came to write this book is pretty fascinating. Can you tell our audiences about it?
Yes, of course. So about 8 years ago, after my dad had passed away, my mom came and visited our home here in Williamstown, Massachusetts. And she brought with her a box of materials that no one in the family, except my dad, even knew existed. And I began to look through the materials, and I was, surprised by what I found. It really contained a treasure trove of information about my grandfather's role on the Manhattan Project, the top secret military project that built the first atom bomb. And it had in it photos and correspondence with Robert Oppenheimer, artifacts, his written recollections of various parts of his unique journey through the early nuclear age, and a lot of the his military papers and so forth, and a lot of it was stamped secret or top secret, and it was just an incredible kind of collection of materials about the early nuclear age, none of which have ever been made public. And I thought, this is fascinating, and it was really the beginning of my own journey into the atomic age, and it led to my visits to a number of archives, both in the United States and in Japan, exploring further my grandfather's role as a physician on the Manhattan Project, as well as the physicians he worked with and their role. So thus the title for the book, Atomic Doctors. It really looks in particular at the role of the doctors on the Manhattan Project, and then into the early nuclear age.
I wonder if you could just back up a little bit and give us some essential background for understanding the story. So what was the Manhattan Project? What role did it play in World War II? And what's the kind of dominant historical narrative about it?
Okay, so the Manhattan Project was the secret project headed by Leslie Groves. He was a military head, and then the scientific head was Robert Oppenheimer. And it was a secret project that was first commissioned by Roosevelt to build the bomb. And it cost something like, in 1945, dollars, $2 billion was spent on this. It was a huge project. And Los Alamos was the place where they the physicists came together to build the bomb, to design it and to test it and so forth. So my grandfather was invited in the very early years of the project in early 1943 to be the head physician at the hospital in Los Alamos. And part of Oppenheimer's thinking was that if he had, you know, medical facilities in place and good medical care, that would help him in his efforts to recruit top physicists to the project. So that's why my grandfather was there and why he was one of the first recruits to Los Alamos. And he was an OBGYN with training in radiology, so it made a lot of sense for him to be there. He had the kind of background that would make sense. In terms of the dominant narrative about the use of the bomb, I mean, within, you know, kind of historical accounts of World War II and of the history of the use of nuclear weapons, there are a couple narratives. I mean, there's the dominant or official narrative, as it's sometimes called, that basically argued that the bomb was necessary, that it ended the war, and that it saved American lives, and that it avoided Americans from having to engage in a costly land invasion that would have cost hundreds of thousands of American and even Japanese lives. The counter-narrative gives more attention to the destruction on the ground in Japan in particular. It gives much more attention to the effects of radiation, the long-term effects of radiation. Part of the counter-narrative is also to argue that a land invasion wasn't necessary, that there was evidence that Japan was willing to negotiate a surrender in the days and weeks before the dropping of the bombs. And it's even argued by some that the dropping of the bomb had more to do with Russia than it did with Japan. That is, that it was in a certain sense the first strike in the emerging Cold War rather than simply the final strike at the end of the World War II. That's a debate, that goes on, that continues to go on, the counter narrative and the official narrative. What I look at in particular is the largely untold story about the role of the doctors on the project. And what's interesting about the doctors is they knew more than most about radiation and the effects of radiation. And as I mentioned, the counter narrative gives a lot more attention to the biological effects of the radiation hazards that follow a nuclear detonation.
And so you mentioned in the book that there has been a lot of work on sort of scientists versus military officials and their roles in this story. How did the doctors differ from the scientists and what's been written about them?
Yes. So in Los Alamos, you had basically three communities. You had the military officers, and you had the scientists, and then you had the much smaller community of medical doctors who were really not part of either of the other two communities. The scientists were primarily concerned with building a bomb. Can we split the atom to release this energy? It was kind of a scientific goal, and scientific discovery was a major motivation. Whereas for the military, they wanted a bomb for combat purposes. A lot has been written about the tensions between the scientists and the military. They both had high levels of disregard for the other. In particular, the scientists didn't really like Leslie Groves. They didn't like the emphasis on security and the kind of surveillance that went on, and the kind of hierarchical nature of military authority and so forth. And the scientists were more accustomed to kind of seminars and symposia and having these kind of conversations and sharing of information and so forth. So they clashed with one another, and the doctors were again in certain senses not part of either of those communities. And yet they were the ones who were both tasked with taking care of the health needs of members of both communities. And also they had a, you know, an important amount of knowledge about radiation and the effects of radiation. The three main doctors that I look at in the book, my grandfather, James F. Nolan, but then also Louis Hempelman and Stafford Warren were all had training in radiology. And so that was an important part of the equation. And given that the scientists were primarily concerned with scientific discovery, can we do this? And the military was concerned about creating a weapon for the purposes of combat. They often really weren't concerned about radiation hazards. As my grandfather put it, radiation hazards were entirely secondary. And so when the doctors raised concerns about the effects of radiation, they were often ignored, or what they said was downplayed and not regarded as seriously as the doctors would have hoped.
So James Nolan is really our guide through this history. And he sort of, he winds up on the site of some pretty important historical events. Can you kind of take us through the book from his point of view? So he, you know, how is he involved in the Trinity test? How is he involved in finally taking, you know, in taking the bomb to Japan? How does his research career evolve after the, you know, after the war? Tell us the story that came to you in this box that you had to sort of weave together.
Yes, sure. So yeah, as I say in the book, he serves as kind of my virtual. He takes me through a divine comedy of sorts, and really the book uses him as a prism to kind of walk through the early nuclear age and look around. And his was a very unusual and unique role. As I mentioned, he was the post surgeon in Los Alamos, and really what he was primarily concerned with in the early months was delivering the many babies who were born on the hill, of which there were quite a few. In the first year alone, something like 80 babies were born in Los Alamos. But then eventually he was pulled over to what was called the health group. And the health group was led by Louis Hempelman, who was a medical school classmate of my grandfather's. And he was, and the health group was really concerned about kind of radiation safety in the lab with people, you know, the people who were working with plutonium and uranium, these kind of toxic materials. And when he moved over to the health group in early 1945, his primary role became helping to establish the safety and evacuation procedures for the Trinity test. Now, the Trinity test was the first bomb to be exploded in human history, and it was exploded in the Alamogordo Desert, Alamogordo bombing range in the New Mexico desert. And again, his task was to kind of take care of, you know, set up the evacuation procedures and be concerned about the safety of the military working at the Trinity site. And kind of the most famous episode that my grandfather was involved in this particular chapter of the early nuclear age was that he went, because of their concerns about the potential radiation fallout from the bomb, he put together with a report with the other doctors and with two sympathetic scientists, and he traveled to Oak Ridge, Tennessee to confront Leslie Groves about their concerns about potential fallout from the Trinity test. And it's an episode that's actually been captured in the opera called Dr. Atomic. And my grandfather met with Groves, gave him the report. He was made to sit outside Groves's office. Groves read the report and then eventually called Nolan in and said to him, "What are you, some kind of Hearst propagandist?" And as my grandfather interpreted it, that it meant that he was primarily concerned with secrecy and security. And if we were to, you know, implement this evacuation plan, it would lead to information about the bomb leaking out, and he didn't want that. So eventually Groves allowed for some of their plans to be put into place. He wasn't enthusiastic about it, but he did allow some to go forward. And again, my grandfather was responsible for that, for setting up the safety and evacuation procedures at the Trinity test. The Trinity test took place on July 16th, 1945. 2 days prior to the test, my grandfather actually left New Mexico, and he left New Mexico because he was asked to escort the Hiroshima bomb from Los Alamos to Tinian Island. The bomb was nicknamed Little Boy, so he escorted Little Boy with a military officer named Robert Furman, who was one of Leslie Groves' top aides. And they literally carried the bomb from Los Alamos. They carried the core uranium, the uranium-235. From Los Alamos, they took a plane from Albuquerque to San Francisco. In San Francisco, the bomb was put aboard the USS Indianapolis, which is an interesting part of the whole story. And they eventually took the cargo off the Indianapolis. The cargo was estimated to cost $300 million at the time. It was the only processed uranium in the world, and it was on Tinian Island that the final assembly of the bomb took place, and that it was put aboard the Enola Gay, and then eventually took its fateful journey from Tinian Island to Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. So my grandfather was on Tinian Island. He was there for the assembly of the bomb. He continued to play a kind of medical role. He examined the crew of the Enola Gay when they came back. I did a medical examination of the entire crew when they returned from Hiroshima. And then he, with a group of three others, conspired to go into Japan to look at the consequences of the bombing. Whether or not their little group was the original source for the Joint Commission, eventually Leslie Groves, in fact, put in place an effort to go into Japan to assess the damages in both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And my grandfather was part of that group. So he actually landed outside of Tokyo on September 5th, 1945, just a few days after the official surrender aboard the USS Missouri. On September 9th, he was part of the very first group of Americans, American officials, to walk into Hiroshima and to look at the damage. So he spent about 5 weeks in Japan, in both Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He spent time in Tokyo, and the purpose of that, was ostensibly to test the to measure the effects of radiation. Leslie Groves was concerned about reports coming out of ongoing radiation poisoning. And so part of it was a kind of a PR effort to find out that there was not residual radiation. And so that was part of what they did. But what they saw in Japan was horrifying. I mean, the devastation was, as my grandfather himself put it, was almost impossible to describe, unimaginable. The Hibakusha, the victims of the bomb, were still dying from both radiation exposure as well as the kind of injuries from the heat and blast of the bomb. And again, it was what he saw was beyond words, and in fact, it really was. He never talked about what he saw in Japan. His time in Japan, again, it lasted about 5 weeks, and then he returned to Los Alamos, and he actually took over from Louis Hempelmann to head up the health group for a short time, before he got out of the military, returned to medical practice, which he desperately wanted to do. He was very keen to get out of the military and go back to being a doctor. However, in this interim period, he did participate in the ongoing testing of bombs in the Marshall Islands. So he was at Bikini and Weetok Atolls, where the United States tested five more bombs. So two bombs at Bikini and then three bombs at Weetok. in the summers of 1946 and 1948. And he participated in those as a radiation safety monitor. And then that really constituted the end of his involvement, direct involvement with nuclear weapons. And after that, he moved, he moved for a short time back to St. Louis and then ultimately to Los Angeles, where he was a gynecological oncologist. And he spent the rest of his career actually treating cancer patients and using different forms of radiation to treat cancer patients.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Do we have any sense of his motivation? Because you say he never spoke about it again. You know, it seems that not that many people maybe who were involved in the bomb got to see the effects of it firsthand. And then that he would go on and continue doing more testing. Can you speculate at all about how he felt about his role in history?
Yeah. Well, he was very quiet about it. And my grandfather passed away in 1983. I was 20 years old. I never once remember talking to him about it. So it was something that he was very quiet about. And I think there are several reasons for that. One is that the notion of secrecy was emphasized over and over again. So among the papers that I have are papers where he has to sign and agree that he will never talk about this. And he had to do that more than once. I mean, it was something that they emphasized over and over again, that this was top secret, that no one was to know about this. And so I think that was part of it. It was beat into them, this idea that this was secret and it was not to be discussed. I also think, and other members of my family who I interviewed for the book, think that he was very troubled by what he saw. He was disturbed by it. And I think that is another reason he didn't talk about it. It was not something that he boasted about or was proud of at all. In fact, when people would ask him about, you know, people who knew about it, and we knew about it, I mean, we generally knew that he was, you know, he played a role in the Manhattan Project. But when asked about it, he would say, I just delivered the babies. You know, that's what he would say. I mean, it seems to me that was the one thing he could be proud of in terms of his role. So for those reasons, I think that he was quiet about it. And I also think that he genuinely wanted to get away from it and use the technology in his view for the good. That is in the realm of medical care.
So the subtitle of the book is Conscience and Complicity at the Dawn of the Nuclear Age. And I wondered if you could talk about this concept of technological determinism, and then how does that relate to the conscience and complicity that your grandfather might have experienced?
Yeah. So in terms of conscience and complicity, I mean, what I find in looking at the doctors is a pattern of what I I call caution, co-optation, and complicity. And so caution or even conscience has to do with the notion that they really did repeatedly warn the military about radiation exposure. They did it at Trinity. They did it before Japan. They did it out in the Marshall Islands. They repeatedly said, you know, this is something we need to worry about. This is dangerous. We need to be concerned about it. And again, the pattern was that the military often ignored them and downplayed their warnings. And in fact, sometimes outright distorted what they said. When Leslie Groves went and testified before Congress after the war in November or December of 1945, he downplayed what the doctors had reported to him about what they found in Japan. I mean, it was just really a straight out, you know, a misrepresentation of what they had said. In fact, he went so far as to say, the doctors tell me that not very many people died from radiation exposure, and that the few who did, that it was, and this is a direct quote, a pleasant way to die. That's what he said to Congress. He reported that the doctors had told him that it was a pleasant way to die, those who were dying. And that was just, no one reported. The doctors never said that. And the doctors knew that, in fact, it was a very agonizing and painful way to die. So this is what I mean about that they did offer warnings. The military often pushed back or distorted or downplayed what they said. But then the doctors were put in this difficult position. Their roles were co-opted. But then at times they actually became complicit. That is, that they themselves participated in the cover-up or hiding of the actual effects of radiation exposure. And the doctors were even involved in something that Eileen Wilson has written about in her book, The Plutonium Files, where they actually injected traces of plutonium in patients at several hospitals around the country in order to examine the effects of radiation on the human body. And they did this without the patient's knowledge or consent. And it was really an unethical and dangerous and very much a violation of the oath that doctors take, you know, first do no harm. So in many ways, I think that that's an example of complicity, where they ultimately became complicit. And in terms of technological determinism, that really comes from Jacques Ellul, and that's the idea that in our technological age, he writes about this in his book, The Technological Society, that once a technology is discovered, it's applied, and it kind of takes on a life of its own, and it's difficult to resist. And a number of the physicists on the project talked about the kind of momentum of the project, such that, you know, even after Germany surrendered, a number of them look back and say, well, why didn't I stop? You know, I was involved in this because we were concerned that Hitler would get a bomb before we would. And yet when that concern ended, they kept working. And in fact, by many accounts, they worked with greater intensity than ever before. And they look back and say, why did I carry on? And in some accounts, they really point to this idea of the kind of momentum of the project, a kind of technological momentum, to use Thomas Hughes' term. Leslie Groves once said of Truman that he actually never made a choice to drop the bomb, that he was like a little boy on a toboggan. That is, when he came in to the presidency after Roosevelt died, he didn't know anything about the Manhattan Project before then, and that he was, once he entered into that role, he was just carried forward, if you will, by the momentum of the project. And I think that's a nice illustration, if you will, of what Ellul means by technological determinism.
And hold on, I'm looking for a part in your book right now. You talk about technological determinism coming in a couple different forms, so optimistic and pessimistic. What you've described sounds very pessimistic to me. I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about what you mean by that, and technological determinism as a driving historical force.
Right. So do you want me to talk about the differences between optimistic and pessimistic technological term?
Yes.
So, some of the examples I just gave were more pessimistic, right? Where people look back and they see that they were determined, but don't, kind of regret that they were determined in that way. Whereas you have others who, people like Ray Kurzweil, for example, who celebrate the kind of technological innovations that are driving us today, and see it as a good thing, and see the resistance, any kind of resistance, as futile. In fact, both optimistic and pessimistic technological determinists see resistance as largely futile. That we're not going to be able to resist. That technology just has this kind of force that carries us forward, and yet the pessimistic technological determinists regret this, and the optimists celebrate it.
I guess determinism, that's what it is. That's a power greater than yourself that's sort of determining the course of your fate or the course of history. Right. You note at various points in the book that figurative language that scientists, the doctors, the government officials were using to talk about the atom bomb, language that portrays the bomb as being religious, transcendent, even healing, which seems counterintuitive to say the least. Yeah. Why did you want your readers to take note of this language that the historical actors in your book were using?
Yes. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the number of kind of religious references are fascinating. I mean, the Trinity test, for example, that's the Trinity comes from, the Trinitarian God of Christian theology. Robert Oppenheimer was reportedly reading John Donne poetry at the time and came up with that. Batter my heart, three person God. It comes from one of the sonnets. So the Tinian Islands military code name was Papacy, and things like this. It's really very interesting. Oppenheimer famously said, or famously recalled, after witnessing the Trinity test and the power of it, citing the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu scriptures, and he remembers thinking, "I have become death, the destroyer of worlds." And there's a certain sense in which he looked at the power of the bomb and realized that what they had participated in was something like playing God, if you will. And also in reflections such as those of Oppenheimer after the war, that was a kind of, and sometimes at least, a kind of regret. We scientists have known sin, he said. And there's a certain sense in which the regret includes perhaps this notion of going to a place we shouldn't go. That is, that there are certain kinds of technological innovations that perhaps we shouldn't participate in, and a kind of with the benefit of looking at the consequences of the technological innovation, a kind of informed regret about what they had participated in. And I think part of what I do also in the book, in the penultimate chapter, is to look at the lessons from the Manhattan Project on this point and apply it to a lot of the new and emerging technologies. And also kind of raise the questions like, is this really a place that we should go? And are we thinking about the long-term consequences of the uses of these technologies? And are we also perhaps, again, a lesson from the Manhattan Project, concerned about this technology taking on a life of its own and becoming deterministic in ways that we as humans lose control of it?
I'd love it if you could say a little bit more about that, about what the relevance of the story of the dawn of the nuclear age might what relevance might this have to us now, and why share your grandfather's story now, other than, well, it's a wonderful discovery and it's a fascinating story, but what does it mean to be interpreting it at this particular moment in time?
Yeah, well, I mean, that the what you said there is an important part of it. I mean, one of the reasons I tell the story now is because it's a story that became available to me as a consequence of my mom bringing me that box of materials. However, you know, I think it is incredible that the story of the Manhattan Project, the story of the invention and the use of the bomb, and then, of course, all that followed that, the Cold War, the development of nuclear weapons, a kind of situation that continues to affect us today, is very important and relevant to understanding technological innovation in a broader sense. There's a wonderful article written by Bill Joy in Wired Magazine in 2000, titled "Why the Future Doesn't Need Us." And in that article, Joy looks at the Manhattan Project, looks at what happened there, and then he looks at kind of new and emerging technologies in the areas of robotics and nanotechnology and artificial intelligence and so forth. And he sees the same patterns at play today. That is, you have the kind of intoxication of scientific innovation and this idea of, you know, can we do this? And the kind of investment in this scientific discovery. And he thinks, you know, in the same way that you can look back and look at the physicists and look at their language after the Manhattan Project, he sees the same sort of danger of people looking back and say, we didn't think about the long-term consequences. We were caught up in scientific discovery and not concerned about what might be the applications of these technologies. And also, he points to the problem of losing control, that we have these kind of innovations that once applied kind of take on a life of its own, and we lose control of it. And it begins to determine us rather than it being a tool that we use for, you know, useful human purposes.
Well, Jim, I said to you before we started recording that one of the things I admire most about your career is how each of your books have covered really seemingly quite disparate topics. So from drug courts to Alexis de Tocqueville to, you know, the dawn of the nuclear age. So I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what do you see as the through line in your work and what you are working on next?
Yeah, sure. If I can conclude on, I'm happy to talk about where I'm going with
sure.
the next project, but just a word on the very last chapter, which is 1983. It was a critical and important year, and it was the year that we have over 60,000 nuclear weapons now throughout the world. It's the year that Ronald Reagan first used the term evil empire to refer to the Soviet Union. You know, the Cold War is very much in play. It was the year that the Day After was broadcast, the most watched TV movie of all time at the time. But it was also the year when the physicists went back to Los Alamos to have a reunion. It was the 40th anniversary of the start of the Manhattan Project, 1983. And many of the physicists there expressed regret about what they had done. Isidore Rabi referred to Los Alamos and said, this place is an abomination. It should have been destroyed at least 30 years ago. Hans Bethe said, we did a terrible thing here. Victor Weisskopf gave a lecture in which he said, we meant so well, but look what we've done. You know, this kind of regret. On my grandfather, you know, he attended that reunion. It was just a few months before he passed away, actually. And Peter Wyden's book about the atomic bomb, he covers that reunion, and he refers to Captain James F. Nolan as the alumni, the most lionized alumni in attendance. And what I like about that is it fits with his own description of his work. I delivered the babies. And Wyden observes that he was the most lionized alumni because of the role that he did in delivering all the children on the hill during the war. And I think that's a kind of a fitting, it's fitting that's acknowledged, and it's also fitting that's the one thing that they could actually celebrate, because they were really regret, they expressed a lot of regret about the technology that they developed. So it was very fascinating to follow my grandfather's journey and to learn a great deal about the early nuclear age. And in the process of researching the book, I went to Japan and spent time in Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and I became very intrigued about the story in Nagasaki, the story of what happened there. It was a second bomb. It doesn't get as much attention as Hiroshima. It was a very unique place. It wasn't even the primary target. Kokura was the primary target. And the only reason it wasn't bombed is because of cloud covering. And then the plane went over to Nagasaki. And then the way that the people in Nagasaki responded is fascinating. So I'm very interested in actually a kind of longer history about Nagasaki. And included in that history would be the story of the bomb, and then the way that they responded to the bomb, and then how Nagasaki is interpreted and remembered today. So that's that. In some ways, that's the gist of the next project that I've begun working on.
Oh, so it really grew right out of this one.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a great project. Jim, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed having the opportunity to talk to you about this new book.